This evening's topic, it may sound at first sight a little misleading to what the ultimate topic is. When we say the Rambam's changed perspectives because of his philosophy, that word philosophy wasn't my choice. I was assigned this topic. But I was very happy with it because, as it turns out, it falls in the Perashat Tzav, that I write about Maimonides. For the past few years, in the Perashat Shavua, I've been refining my writing about Maimonides on sacrifices. And there's quite a bit that overlaps with this evening's talk. But it's a very important discussion because when we talk about change, we're talking about fallibility, we're talking about being human, and we're talking about the tradition of the Jewish people must recognize the distinction between the prophetic era, the biblical era, if we may call it that, and the post-prophetic era. And we're so accustomed when we study Torah to think of everything as, I could almost say, that it's all simultaneous, it's all one unit, because it's all coming from the Pia Gevura, as we say, coming from the Almighty. Not that that's the correct view, that we should look at prophecy as monolithic. It would not be correct to look at it that way, but halakha comes down that way. It comes down that it's all sort of on an equal level, and we attribute to it a certain sanctity, and we don't realize that halakha must be an outgrowth of the situation of the time to a certain degree. When I say an outgrowth, that means based on the tradition and the individuals who are being posek halakha, the Beit Din, the rabbis, are living in the here and now, and they're working with the tradition. They give the tradition a tremendous amount of validity, but it's not superseding their experiences and their recognition of reality. And we learn that from the Rambam's life. Not that he ever speaks about that, and not that anybody speaks about that in the tradition, but we do recognize it as we see him moving from Pirush Mishnayot, which he wrote in the earlier part of his life. Pirush Mishnayot, the Rambam was born, most historians think he was born in the year 1135 and passed away 1204. There's a little dispute about the 1135 years. Some think it's a little later. Kapach, who's one of the major translators of the Rambam and a fan of the Rambam, thinks it's maybe 1138. But most scholars place his birth 1135. 1168, he would be 33 years old. That's when Pirush Mishnayot was completed. And 1180 would be when Mishneh Torah was completed, the code of Jewish law, the first code that was comprehensive, that was published in our nation's history. And about 1190 would be when the God the Perplexed, the Moreh Nebuchim, was completed. All these works were done piecemeal, that were given out. Mishneh Torah was given out in parts, and there's a record of communities writing him, asking him for more, and he did spend 10 full years dedicating to Mishneh Torah. But these three works, Pirush Mishnayot, Mishneh Torah, and Moreh Nebuchim, all exhibit a different orientation. And we'll talk a little bit about that this evening, and we'll also probe a little bit into the explanations, the philosophy behind some of those changes. And I'll leave this point to be discussed as we go along. The point that I'm leaving is the importance of the topic. the importance of recognizing changes in one of the greatest luminaries after the Talmud. Some would say even counting the Talmud, one of the greatest luminaries, because he did, in addition to a great halachic service to the Jewish people, he did a great service as far as solving certain philosophic problems that had been plaguing the more enlightened Jewish people of the time. And he did set Torah on a movement that it was able to cope with the serious issues that would come up from world philosophy. So now we'll begin with the first topic. I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to distribute a sheet about this, but the sheet's in Hebrew. The reason is because I only have the sources that I can copy from on the computer in Hebrew, so I don't have them translated. So they are available, but unfortunately I don't have it. So I'm going to give out a sheet now that has to do with, and the first issue we'll discuss tonight is the Kan Sipur, that the Rambam changes his position as far as how to interpret the law of the Torah, that if there's a nest with eggs and a mother bird or little chicks, that the mother bird is still necessary for them and she's hovering over them, you're not permitted to take those young or the eggs with the mother around. You must take away the mother and then you can take them. The Torah is not telling you can't take them. Of course, it will turn out usually that a person would end up not taking them, but he has to chase away the mother and then take away the young. So this is an issue that today has become very sensitive in present-day Jewish circles, because some people think, you know, it's a good thing to go and look for that nest and chase away the mother and take the young. I think that that's totally misconstruing the halakha. The halakha is people that live in a society, say a subsistence society, subsistence economy, where they need those eggs or they need those young, they're going to take them, so there's a proper way to do it. You don't let the mother see you taking them away, chase her away first. So, okay, she'll come back and she'll notice that they're not there, but it's not the same as when you do it in front of her. So on that, the Rambam has a statement in Mishneh Torah, based on the Mishnah and Gemara, and then he has a statement in the Moreh. So I'm going to pass these out. Pass these down from here. Pass these down from here. Excuse me? Well, it was a practical issue because it was everyday occurrence. People would always be taking them. Wherever you found a nest, they would take the young. People don't pass it by. In subsistence economies, people never pass by the opportunity to have more food. The chance of life, you must have it, and that's the way they used to live. They would always be taking eggs and... Anyway, there's a Mishnah on this. We'll do this very quickly because there are lots to tonight's topics. We're not going to finish the agenda that I have, but we have many topics that we have to talk about. Very quickly, look at the second side of this sheet is the last topic of tonight. So now we'll do the Hebrew side. In the Gemara, Berachot, the Mishnah says, Ha'omer, if the Shaliach Tzibur, in the days of old, the reader, the person representing the congregation, the Chazan, he had the liberty to add to the Tachanunim. He could put his own formulation in. It's not like today that everybody just follows the Siddur exactly as if it's theurgy instead of liturgy. Pick that up from Chacham Yitzchak Sassoon. People act like theurgical. So in those days, a Chazan had more liberty. So let's read the Mishnah. Ha'omer al-kan sipor yagir rachamecha. He say, God, just as your mercies reach the bird's nest, similarly, have mercy upon us. Similarly, I mean, the Mishnah doesn't bring that part down. Are there more sheets around over there? We'll have some more over here. Okay, we'll have some over here. So the person who says, Akan Sipor Yagiu Rahamecha, and therefore, of course, have mercy on us also. And I'm not going to spend time for Al Tuvi Zechishcha, Modim Modim, they say twice. So, Mishat Kinotor. The Mishnah says that the law is you must silence him. You take him down for being Hazan. You're not allowed to say that. You can't say. So the Gemara is Bishma Modim Modim, Mishat Kinotor. We can understand why he said Modim twice. You have to keep because Mishum Dim Hazir Kashtir Shiyot. In their days, there was the threat of the Zoroastrian philosophy that believed there were two powers in the world, and if he says Modim Modim, maybe he means to give thanks to both powers. Anyway, the Gemara says, we're not going to question that. It looks like it's too short, and Hazan would not be allowed to say that, and that's halakha. We never say Modim twice. When we're praying privately, publicly, you don't say Modim twice. Also that Nameh Mashma Al-Tub, only for good things God's name should be mentioned. No, we can't allow that. So no question on B and C, but what about A? Ela akan sipori girahamecha. My tama, the Gemara, for a moment, is wondering, what's the problem? It sounds okay, which is very important for us to note. Peligi batre moraim maraba, two imoraim argue about this, Rabbi Yosef barabim, Rabbi Yosef bar Zabida. Hadamar one says, Pnesh matil kenav marse bereshit. He's differentiating that God's mercies are only on the tenth sipor, it's not on tigers and lions, even though his mercies are on everything and so on. We can't accept that. Behind Amar Pnesh Yosef, the Tavshak Kashbarachu, Rahamim, Fenan Ela Gezerot. It's because he makes God's laws, his decrees, like they're merciful, because they're stemming from mercy, and they should not be looked at except as gezerot, decrees. So, anyway, we'll go a little bit further. We'll finish this little piece we have here. Hahu denahit kamed rabba ve'amar. This person who, in front of Rabba, he was the Hazan, he said, Ata hasta kan sipor, ata chus rahim aleinu. God, you had pity on the cancer board, please have pity on us also. Amar Abba, come here, Dahai Surban Rabbanan, Lirisuye Lemare. How well this Talmid Hacham knows how to speak to his master, Lirisuye Mare, like the peace is made to God. So Amar Abaye, Behamishat Kinoto Tinan. How can you say that it's so nice? It's Asur, we have to keep him quiet. The Gemara says, Rabbah Name, he knew that. Yeah, I mean, of course he knew that. He was only sharpening Abaye. He only, sometimes the rabbis speak in a sense that they're interested in saying the opposite of the halakha, just testing out their colleague or their students. That's what the Gemara says about this. Now, this sounds like that the conclusion of the Gemara is that the Mishnah should be taken in its literal sense, and that it's not allowed to define the laws of the Torah as stemming from God's mercy. That's what it sounds like in the Gemara. Now we look at the Mor and the Rambam, Hilchot Tefillah, take a look at the next piece. Hilchot Tefillah, he says, Mi she'amet tehanonim, whoever says in his supplications the following, Mi she'rihem akan sipor, he, the Almighty, who had pity on the kan sipor, she'lekaha'im ala benim, or she'loshchot oto ve'teno be'yom echad. Similarly, the law in Vayikra that you're not to slaughter the mother with the child on the same day, he, because then it's like very sad, you destroy the whole family and so on. He who had that mercy, Yerachem Aleinu, whoever says that, Chaseh Be'inyan Zeh, and anything similar to this, Meshakin Oto, we don't allow the Hazan, remember in those days the Hazan had the latitude to say extra things, because Hanim was very much in flux in those days. We silence him. They're not rahamim. That's what the Rambam posek, exactly like the Mishnah with the Gemara, the second opinion in the Gemara. He's posek it exactly, and then he adds something very interesting, which I feel reflects. What's that?
Why is it not rahamim?
No, they're not. No, that's the laws are not they're decrees. They're the decrees from a king. We have decrees. We can't go in giving explanations. That's what the Mishnah says. That's where they understand. You can't go give explanations. You have a law, do the law. Don't start giving explanations. Just do the law. Gezrat HaMelech. It's a decree. And that's what it sounds like the Gemara is saying. That's what it sounds like the Mishnah is saying. And that's what the Rambam is posek in Mishnah Torah.
Don't give explanations at all, or just don't give that explanation?
Well, it sounds like don't give explanations at all, because it's a Gezrat HaMelech. This was an explanation that some people thought they were giving. And the Mishnah says, no good, you can't do that. The way the Gemara interprets it is Gezrat HaMelech. He's making Midotev Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rachamim. So you don't give explanations. You just follow the laws, because that's the law. There's still a school of thought around in Judaism today that looks at things that way. Now, the Rambam now, I think it's correct to say that we could, we're coming later with a lot of psychological sensitivity, and we can detect in the Rambam's following words that he was bothered by this Mishnah and this Halakha. He was bothered by it. So what he did in Mishneh Torah, in a code of law, he gave a reason why it's not for mercy. It sounds like it's for mercy, of course. It sounds like God wanted you not to take away the young while the mother's watching. It sounds, or Torvet Beno is the same thing. Don't destroy the whole family. It sounds like Rachamim plays a role, but the Rambam says, no, I go like the Mishnah and the Gemara, but I'm going to prove to you that it's not Rachamim. Because if it was really Rachamim, that's what the Rambam says, She'ilu hayu p'nei Rachamim, if these laws were Rachamim, lo hayam ati lanu shechita kol ikar. This is a Mishneh Torah, the Rambam is saying. The Torah would have prohibited slaughtering any animal, and you wouldn't be allowed to eat animals. You have to become vegetarian. V'chein, so therefore, v'chein lo yerbeh b'kunim shel shem v'yamar ha'adro g'bon ra. That's another thing you shouldn't do. The Chazan shouldn't do. Okay, that's another halacha. You would not be allowed to have shechita, which means you would not be allowed to eat animal food.
That's not very convincing, because the whole issue here is the double edge. So you can't compare it, the Rachamim factor, towards any shechita, which is just one animal.
No, shechita, the whole realm of shechita, that human beings are allowed to be allowed to eat meat.
But there's a differentiation here, or to all the Ezeno,
you think he's playing devil's advocate, or you think he's actually believing that?
Okay, I think he actually believed it at this stage of his life. That's a very important question, but I don't want to discuss it yet. I'd like to discuss it in 45 minutes from now, that question. I think he really believed it. Excuse me?
How old was he?
Well, he finished writing Mishneh Torah in 1180. He was born 1135. He was 45 when he finished, but he wrote it right in order.
Excuse me, is the fire outside with the wife who likes licking, the New Jersey place Acura?
Yeah.
Who likes licking? So close to the
If anybody doesn't have a sheet, we have more to do.
There's another nuance that might be when you take these two mitzvahs of Tovet Beno and Anti Por, in both cases, if there is an element of mercy in our Hava Amina, so to speak, in both cases we're showing a little bit of mercy by not killing the Eprochim or the Ben in the presence of the mother. But what kind of that's a kind of limited mercy, because we're still ultimately killing the Ben in both cases.
Well, I know, but you're chasing the mother away, taking away the child, and whatever you do afterwards, you do.
So what I'm leaving afterwards, I was trying to say is, if we try to compare the mercy we want Hashem to show to us to this kind of conditional mercy, if we will, that's not the kind of mercy we're trying to that Hashem should give us. We don't want to, that, you know, Chas v'Shalom, whenever there's a genocide, don't let the parents and children be killed together. Chas v'Shalom. So that's probably
not unlimited mercy.
I know, but I think that the Shaliach Sibur, that the Mishnah is protesting, and that the Rambam then protests, I think he's having kavanah, just God, you manifested your mercy in your laws in the Torah, manifest your mercy on us. I think that's really the intention of Shaliach Sibur. At any rate, in the Moreh, now keep in mind, the Rambam was born 1135, concluded the Mishneh Torah 1180, and concluded the Moreh Nevuchim 1190. It's approximately right. There might be slight differences, but this is the standard accepted opinion amongst the scholars. I mean, the Rambam himself dates the works. That's how we know them. He dates them from the Shtaror. It's a little different. So now let's read what he says in the Moreh Nevuchim. V'chasher hevi echreyach tova mazon laharigat ba'alei hayim, and as the need to have good food, the need to have good food brought the permission that we should be able to kill animals. So kivanat Torah lekala shebemitot, the Torah intended to give you the easiest type of death of an animal. Therefore, we ended up with shehita and the laws of shehita that you're not allowed to have a certain kind of knife. You can have blemish in a knife and all, so on. So the lekala shebemitot veasra. The Torah prohibited that we should afflict the animal b'shechita ra'a with a poor shechita, the lo b'nechira or stabbing the animal. Lo yachatech mehem ebed kmo shebi'anu. You're not allowed to cut off a limb from a live animal the way we Rambam says. V'chein asa lishchot oto v'et beno b'yom echad. You can't do that, like we just said before. Lishamer u'harchik lishchot mishnehem haben le'nei ha'em. You can't do the child in front. Ki sar b'alei ha'yim b'zeh gadol me'od. Because even animals have tremendous pain. En efresh min sar ha'adam alav v'sar she'ar b'alei ha'yim. In this respect, man and animals, we're all similar in this respect. We're in this respect of the sar b'alei ha'yim and human beings. I mean, we all feel that pain. We don't say that we feel pain more deeply than animals. Okay, that's the drama. Maybe today we might feel a little differently about the degree of pain. Anyway, ki ahavat ha'em v'rahameha ala valed eno nimshach ahara sechel, because the love of a mother for her child, it's not dependent upon intellect. Rak ahar poel ha'koach ha'medamer. It goes after the functioning of the imaginative faculty, which most animals do have. In most animals, it's like in a human being. This halakha applies to the animals that we're allowed to eat. From the domesticated animals that we're accustomed to eat. And the mother recognizes her child, she knows the child. This is also the reason b'shua haken. Ki abetzim, eggs, asher shachva ha'em alehem, that the mother had laid upon, the efrohim and the young, hatzirichim lemam, that need their mother, ala rov en amrim lechila. Usually they're not yet fit for eating. Uchsheishlah ha'em v'telech la. And when you send away the mother and she goes away, she shouldn't feel the pain of taking away the child, which she would feel if you did it in front of her. And the Rambam feels, since this law prohibits you to take them standard, you have to chase away the mother, usually you know what you'll end up doing? You just pass on it. You hear Sibel and Yahakol, you just leave everything. Because what you're going to get, it's not yet a young bird, it's not yet fit, it's not so much meat on it. Anyway, the im elu hatzarim hanafshiyim hasa tura lehem bebehemot be'afod kol shekim bebnei adam ve'lo tekshe alai. Now, don't ask me the question from the Mishnah in Berachot and the Gemara over there. Don't ask me that question, the Rambam says now. V'lo tekshe alai be'omram al kan sipor yigiru hamecha, etc. Meshatkin oto Now why? Because that Mishnah, ki hu lefi ahat mishteh hadeot asher zechanum, they go according to the other opinion that I already in the previous chapter, that this is chapter 48 and part 3. In the previous chapter, he was discussing the different views amongst the philosophers about God's activity. And there's another school of thought that thinks that we don't have, not only don't have the right, God's activity should not be explained in terms that human beings can understand, or that human beings have a right to interpret God's activity. God does his things for his reasons. We finite, puny beings, we have no right to think that we know God's reasons. And there's a school of thought that we don't give reasons. But the Rambam, previously to this chapter, disagreed with that point of view, and he said, God is doing things in relation to the earth, in relation to human beings, and he expects, they have purposes for us, and he expects us to recognize those purposes, and that's his philosophy. So he says, don't ask me from that Gemara in Berachot, that Mishnah, because that goes according to the other opinion. The opinion of the one who thinks she'en tam l'Torah ela harason lebad. There's only God's will. There's nothing more than God's will. V'anachnu nimshachnu ahar hadat hasheni. And we follow the second opinion. Now, this is a very important statement of the Rambam. It was very courageous for him to say it, because you must keep in mind that he already had given out Mishneh Torah. It's one of the rare works that became a booming success in the life of its author. Later on, there was a century of strife with the Rambam's works, and they burnt his books, and it was a terrible era in Jewish history, where when the Moreh Nevuchim became widespread, after Rambam's death, for the most part, it was the following century. He passed away in 1204, but that century, there were terrible situations that came up during Rambam. But eventually, he became accepted as the posek of Klal Yisrael. But even in his lifetime, his books were very popular, and they were asking for more chapters as he was giving them out. So the Mishneh Torah had already been very popular. And he already gave out a pisak, and he was known for that pisak. He was posek of the Mishnah, and he's part of a community. By this time, he was already the leader of the Egyptian community in Cairo, Fastat, right outside, that's old Cairo, right outside Cairo. He was already the leader of the community for years. He was corresponding with the leaders throughout the world, and he was saving the Jews in Yemen and in North Africa. He had done a lot for the Jews through the previous decades. For the Rambam to change his position on a pisak that he was already known for, it was very courageous. But he set a tone for us, for all those that follow and recognize what he was doing. If you change your philosophy, you change your philosophy. You have to go with the truth at all costs. This is the truth. When I said all costs, there are some limitations. But the Rambam recognized that he hadn't thought out the philosophy. This is my opinion. I mean, Dr. Jason asked before, maybe he always held this opinion, but he wanted to write the other way and so on. I don't think that's correct. It doesn't look that way in Mishneh Torah. It follows very smoothly. There's no other, I'm going to show you other indications of Mishneh Torah. He didn't change his mind about such matters until later in his life. It was not in Mishneh Torah. Yes?
Why does he only refer back to the Mishnah and its second opinion and not his own opinion in Mishneh Torah?
No, his own opinion doesn't count. It's the Mishnah's opinion. You can't ask him from his own opinion. So,
to clarify that he changed his own position.
Yeah, he
changed. Why not say, I am changing my position?
No, it's not. A scholar says, you're not going to ask against me from what I wrote. You're going to ask against me from the Mishnah. You can't refute me from what I wrote. This is my position today, that we are allowed to say, let's say, we're allowed to say Akan Sipur. That's my position today. Don't ask me that I once said you're not allowed to say, so I made a mistake. The Rambam writes his letter. He makes mistakes. He's fallible. But you ask on him from the Mishnah. Remember, for those of you who are not very familiar, I'll call you in a second. For those who are not very familiar, standard halachic procedure is that the Mishnah is the codification par excellence of the laws of the Torah, and the Gemara's explanation. The Mishnah was finalized in about the year 200, and the Gemara about the year 5 to 600, somewhere in that century or so. And subsequent to that, we don't argue against the conclusions of the Talmud unless very compelling reasons. And here it looks like there was a conclusion to the Talmudic sugya, and that's a very powerful question against the Rambam, that you're going against the conclusion of the Talmud. We cannot underestimate the degree of authority that the Mishnah and Gemara, when it comes to conclusion, carries in the traditional Jewish world. This has always been our source. It's not the Bible, but it's right next to the Bible. It's Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, and we must give it the full measure of authority. Yes?
It seems to me that the Rambam is interpreting Mishnah differently than I. It doesn't seem to me that the Mishnah is saying that the Torah is Ela Leratzon Levad. It sounds like what the Mishnah is saying is that it's not that you can't create, you can't put reasons for what's in Torah. It seems to be saying, though, you can make reasons, but you can't base conclusions on those reasons. You can't build upon those reasons that you created. Like, if Torah says something, you could, create timing for it, but don't premise other things on that. Don't say, it's because that, and because it's that reason...
I'll tell you. With the Gemara explanation of Enan Ela Gizrat Melech, with that explanation, it becomes like a package. That's sort of the Mishnah. Although I'll agree with you that we have a right today, we have a right subsequent to Mishnah to interpret the Mishnah differently than the Gemara, but that's also another very sensitive issue. Today there are scholars out in the world who say, let's study the Mishnah, see what the Mishnah is saying. Hey, well, one second, how can you study the Mishnah? Look what the Gemara says. The Gemara is like an authoritative explanation of the Mishnah. So when the Gemara says that this Shaliach Sibur is putting Rahamim at the foundation of God's laws, of this particular law, and they're only Gezrat HaMelech, so it's sort of, the Gemara interpretation is sort of it's forcing the point. Although I do agree with you that if we read the Mishnah alone, we might come up with a different interpretation than the Gemara's.
Is there another precedent for that? Or just to say
no, that's that the whole traditional Jewish world from post-Talmudic times till today takes the Gemara's interpretation of the Mishnah as somewhat authoritative. I said it was somewhat, not that it's so small a degree. It's a great degree. It's just not the same as when the Mishnah says it absolutely clearly. If the Mishnah is not absolutely clear and we pick it up from the Gemara, it's not the same. But here, this was accepted to be the main thing. There was an early opinion in the Gemara that says, Matil ken av ma'aseh bereshit, which doesn't sound the same as he's making them rahamim to get them melech. But this second opinion was sort of accepted as the normative opinion. And we didn't, in the traditional interpretation of Jewish law, we don't find that the rabbis go back to the Mishnah and interpret it differently than the Gemara and come up with something. It wasn't a popular approach. Today, because there are scholars who go back and look at everything, they say, well, let's look at it without the later additions, without the later interpretations. So they're doing that with the Mishnah also, but not in the traditional Jewish world. Yes?
Is the Rambam's revised opinion, does it have only philosophical ramifications, or does it have halachic ramifications? Meaning, the question is, would you say that the Rambam is now forsake differently in the Morin Elohim,
I think he'd have to be forsake differently. He would not hold that you have to stop the Shaliach Sibur, as the Mishnah said. He says that Mishnah is Shelok Hilcheta. That goes not like halacha, that Mishnah. He doesn't say those words, but that's what the Rambam is saying. He said, don't ask me from that case, because that case goes according to an opinion that we reject. We reject that. We reject the law of the Mishnah with it. you can't say we reject that Mishnah, but we keep the Halakha. Now, he did give the Halakha of the Mishneh Torah, and the world was fulfilling it that way. Everybody interpreted the laws that way in Hilchot Tefillah. Hilchot Tefillah, by the way, he concluded very early, because if you finish the Mishneh Torah in 1180, and he started somewhere about 1170, so this was undoubtedly in the early 1170s. So he was much younger.
Is it possible to interpret that he was just trying to talk about commandments both and not revising the Halakhic opinion?
I don't think so. I think the Rambam's Lashon is not that way. And you'll see he's consistently like that. And the Rambam is not. I don't think that would be the correct. It doesn't sound that's what he's saying. And he's telling you, don't ask me from that Mishnah, because that Mishnah goes according to the other opinion.
Are there other Rishonim who reach a different conclusion regarding the Halakha?
Yes. Actually, they do. I'm going to distribute something a little bit later, but I don't want to confuse the issue now. I'm going to distribute something where I have a footnote on the Ramban, who does have an interpretation. He says, I hold they have reasons, and I still could follow the Mishnah. He has an interpretation of the Gemara and the Mishnah, but we're not very convinced by it. But anyway, now I'd like to change the subject. I have actually 10 topics tonight. We're only going to cover 3 of them, or 4 of them, I don't know. But I'm taking topics that I wrote about, and that it happens to be that this is very, I don't know, Sahashkaha. It happens to be that tonight is the night that I would be, actually I did send it out today, that I do write on Kan Sipur, and I do write on the next topic in this week, throughout the whole year. This is the one week that I write about these topics. And you didn't know that, Rabbi Ricky, when we planned for tonight, but it came out just right. Exactly just right. The beginning of the week that I write about you. Now, the next topic I'd like to talk about, we're building a case now. Next topic is about construction of the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the Mishnah says that the cutting of stones for the temple, since you're not supposed to use metal on those stones, now that's a little problem, that whole subject, because it says, "Im isbach abanim ta'aseri lo tibnei etin gazit ki harvecha naftaleha v'techaleleha." If you make a simple altar for me out of earth, that's what after the Ten Commandments, the Torah says, make a simple altar before the laws of the tabernacle, the laws of the Mishkan. It says, "Mizbach adamat ta'aseli, v'im mizbach abanim ta'aseli lo tibnei etin gazit." Don't build it with finished stones. Because you lift your metal instrument upon it and you profane it. Metal instrument brings death, the Beit HaMikdash brings life, and so on, whatever, the altar brings life, whatever reasons you want to give. Those are like a standard reason that's given, that she might say. I'm not going to go into that. But the Mishnah says, and the Rambam in his interpretation of the Mishnah says, and he gives explanation. He says that, let's read what the Rambam says. There's a worm called the Shamir, which was an amazing worm. You put it, maybe you'd have to draw a line, maybe. You put it where you want it to cut, and it just cuts right through. Amazing, this insect. Let's read others. Right. Let's read Pirush Rambam. Look at the next source. Pirush Rambam Le'avot. He says this twice, once in Sotah and once in Pirkei Avot, chapter 5. We're almost up to there in our morning class. We're up to chapter 4. Pirkei Mishnah here. Over there it says 10 different items were created in the 6 days of creation. On the sixth day, after sunset, Ben Hashem Ashot, before the stars came out, Asad Debrin Nevi'u, Ben Hashem Ashot.
The rainbow,
there's different things. Pi Ator, the donkey's mouth of the Lam. There were 10 things created then. One of them is the Shamir. That's the Mishnah. And then in Sotah, it also says, Mishir Batla, this, the Kohanim, then Batla Shamir. So the Rambam, look at the Rambam's words. Pirush Rambam le'avot pirkei mishnah he be shamir Hubal Hayim Katan, it's a small creature. Yenasir Ha'avanim, it cuts stones. Hagedolot Be'ovro Alehen, when it passes over them. Ubo Banash Shilomo HaMikdash, and with it, King Solomon built the temple. Now, this is an involved sugya that I brought you down from Sotah. I'm going to really just summarize it very, very quickly. There's an argument. First, okay, we'll look at it first, because Mishahara Beit HaMikdash, Batil HaShamir, Tanur HaBanan, Shamir, Shebo Banash Shilomot Beit HaMikdash, Ne'emar, it says in Melachim, V'habayit V'banoto, Eben Shilemah Masat Libne, with complete stones, Masat, they carry them complete. Hadevarim Kechdavan, Dever B'Yehuda, that's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, he used the Shamir. Amal Rabbi Nehemiah, V'echi Yoshan Amar, Ken V'alo Kevan Ne'emar, it says over in Melachim, Kol Ele Avanim Yekarot, Megorarot, Megaret, that's a type of a saw, a metal saw. You didn't hear any sound. So Rabbi Nehemiah says, "Shaya matkin mebahutz umachnis lefnim." You cut them outside at the mountain site, and you bring them in already finished. That was allowed to do. That's Rabbi Nehemiah. So, but that's Bevner. That's Rabbi Nehemiah. So, one second. Shaya matkin mebahutz umachnis lefnim. Amar Rabbi. Now, there's an argument between two different Tanaitic sources. The Biyoda says he used a Shamir. The Binahmiya says he didn't use a Shamir. Rabbi, the Biyoda Hanasi, he's the authority, he's the one who put the Mishnah together. So Rabbi says, Amar Rabbi, Nir'in Devei Rabbi Yehuda Ve'Avnei Mikdash. I think Rabbi Yehuda is right when it comes to the stones for the temple, that it was with the Shamir. Ve'Devei Rabbi Nehemiya Ve'Avnei Beto. If you look at seeing the account in Sefer Melachim about how Solomon built his home, Rabbi says, I agree that it was not done with the Shamir. That was done with cutting the stones. So then again, this is the main line that we need. The Rabbi Nehemiah, who says that they cut them with saws, they cut the stones, so what purpose did the Shamir serve, according to him? We know there's a Shamir. Shamir, what did it come for? We need it, look at Tanya, Avinim Halalu, the stones, this is referring to different stones, the stones that the Kohen Gadol had on the Urim Vetumim, you had to write on them, the tribes, and when you had to write, it's very hard to write without taking away some of the material of the stone. How are you supposed to carve and preserve the fullness of the stone? You're not allowed to take away from the fullness of the stone. So here's what it is. Shema lemaya, that would have come from. Maybe later, the time you need it for the following. Avinim alalu, en kotino tan bidayo, you don't write with ink. Mishum shene amar, pituhe hotam. It has to be engraved, pituhe hotam. The end is sartin alehem bizemel, you can't scratch out with a razor. Mishum shene amar bimilu hotam. They have to be complete. You can't take any little scrapings away. Here's what you do. You write with ink on the top. You show them the shamir from the outside. And they split on their own. And there's no material that's missing. They just split like the dates. Like a teinah, sometimes in the summertime, the fresh dates, as it gets ripe and ripe, it splits. Like teinah, nothing's missing, it's all there. Like a bikazu, or sometimes in the winter when it's cold and things contract and the valley splits open. Okay, and Tanur Rabbanan, Shamir Zeh, B'riyato Kisya'ura, it starts off like a little barley grain. U'mishesh Yimeh B'Rishit Nivra, it was great. V'en Kol Davar Kasheh Yachol Amor V'Fanav. Nothing can stand in its way. It can overcome the hardness of any item in the world. Now that is what the Gemara says about the Shamir. The Rambam in Pirush HaMishnayot, obviously, twice in Sotah and in Arvot, He defined Shamir like an actual creature that existed. But when you go to Chutbit Tabihira, and you go to anyway, Mishnah, I happen to be this afternoon after Arbit, I said, you know, let me be able to say that I made a search throughout all Mishneh Torah. So I went to the Bari Ilan program, I put in the word Shamir, of course came out hundreds of times, Shamir, put in the word Shamir, and I wanted to see how many times in Mishneh Torah. It's zero. It's never quoted in Mishneh Torah, the Shamir. And the Rambam explains, the Beit HaMikdash, he goes like the Dini Hamya, that it was done with cunning, away, as long as it was away from the site, it was allowed to do. The Rambam is posek like the Dini Hamya. So the case of Mishneh, and the Mishneh LeMelech, and all the commentators say, how could the Rambam posek like the Dini Hamya? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said, Nir'im Devrei Rabbi Yehuda, not to confuse the Rabbi Yehuda with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he says, I think that Rabbi Yehuda is correct that the Beit HaMikdash was built with the Shamir. So when you have an argument between the two, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehemia, the rule is when Rabbi enters the picture and he tells you what he thinks, you follow what Rabbi thinks in that kind of a controversy. That's the standard rule in Gemara, Pesach. So how did the Rambam go against that? That's what all the Mefarshim ask. They say, how did he go against that? Now, nobody says this in the standard commentators of the Rambam, but it appears to me that the Rambam, when he got older, based on his own studies and his own experience in life and his own understanding of the Mishnah and the Gemara, I think he attributed the Shamir to the world of legend. And there's a lot of Talmudic, not a lot, a fascinating but fantastic Talmudic story about the Shamir. How do you get the Shamir? And if anybody's interested, I brought a few copies of the study on the Shamir, and you'll be able to take them if you're interested in reading about it. But it's a subject that I started once on responding to somebody on Neil Jewish who asked a question. He said, I remember learning that no metal tools might be used to cut the stones for the Beit HaMikdash. Originally there was a worm that would eat through a rock, but is believed to be extinct. How do we cut the stones? That's if somebody asked that question, and I responded. If anybody's interested, you can take this, and then you can read the English translation of that whole fascinating story about Hagishmi. It's such a fascinating story, but I'm not even going to repeat it tonight. It'll take up another 15 minutes, and we're going to skip that. Now we're going to talk about this topic that we just... The Rambam in Pirush Mishnayot was relatively young. When I say relatively, because he came out with it over a period of years, but he had finished it in 1168, which would make him 33 years old. Not so young, of course. Alexander the Great was already the conqueror of the world by that age. But it was relatively young. It was young enough that... Now, there's a letter that the Rambam wrote many years later, maybe 1180s or 1190s, she wrote a letter. I think 1190s, one maybe, because I think it was after the Moreno King came out. He wrote a letter and he said, he's speaking to a student who was in another city, maybe in Baghdad, and the Rambam's in Egypt, and he says, I advise you, don't let these people, because the Rambam, as much as he was accepted, but there were also detractors, like the one of the Baghdadian rabbis who was considered the Gaon, he wanted to consider himself the continuation of the Gaonic dynasties of Babylonia, which had gone on for centuries in the Jewish community. The Gaonim were the heads of the Jewish community throughout the world. So this one, it appears, was begrudging the Rambam's popularity and success and tried to downgrade him. So when the Rambam's students was there in Baghdad, so he said, don't be bothered by these things. So he said, look, and we all make mistakes. I made mistakes in my Pirush Mishnayot. I made quite a few mistakes. He says, but this is what he writes. He said, but most of my mistakes were because I trusted the Geonim's interpretations. But then when I went into the subjects, I saw that they were mistaken. And he said, and I corrected them. He says, the Rambam tried to correct, even though it was sent out, he tried sometimes to correct, which is another topic to keep in mind for a little bit later. He tried to correct things, but he didn't always try to correct everything. This is a very fascinating subject. When the Rambam felt it was important to correct something that he had written that he was mistaken on, and when he didn't feel it was important to correct something that had gone like his first opinion, because that'll bear on our whole topic. At any rate, that's what he says. I think that the case of the Shamir, the Rambam followed, because look what he had to follow. He had the Mishnah to follow. It's not the Geonim. He had two Mishnayot, the one in Sotah and the one in Avot. He had two Mishnayot, and he had a very rich tradition to follow. But when it came to being eventually in Posek Halacha, years later, he probably realized that it was all part of Agadah. Somehow it made its way through into Halacha, but he'll correct it. He'll Posek. Look, Rabbi Nehemiah didn't hold that the Beit HaMikdash was built as a Shamir. So there was an argument. If there's an argument, so, okay, the Gemara says, well, what would Rabbi Nehemiah do with the Shamir? You have to do Shamir, Shamir, we have a tradition on the Shamir. So, Rabbi Nehemiah, the Gemara says, Rabbi Nehemiah doesn't actually say it himself. It's not his words. It's words said on his behalf, because the Gemara does this very often. Like if two rabbis are arguing in the Gemara, in a later generation, they may have passed away already. In a later generation, the Gemara might be debating the meaning of what they said. So, here the Gemara that asked, what would Rabbi Nehemiah do with the Shamir? So the Gemara answered, he'll use it to say that that's what Shilamor did. It means the people in the building of Bangladesh, to carve out the writing on the stones of the Urim Vetumim, of the Hoshen. Those 12 stones we had to write. So the Shebatim, they'll use it for that. The Rambam won't protect that. But you recognize that it's not Rabbi Nehemiah said that. Rabbi Nehemiah didn't hold it a Shamir. That's simple. You could say that. The Gemara later said, no, the Shamir is something that we should take as a given. Well, the Rambam didn't feel that it had to be taken as a given. Now, a little bit later, we're going to see where the Rambam will even say, if we come up with scientific proof, we could change our minds even from something that they said in the Mishnah. He actually says that explicitly in his letter to Marseille, and I'm going to give you a source on that soon. He says that if the rabbis in the Midrash, in the Mishnah, the Midrash, in the Gemara, wherever it may be, he mentions all those places. He said, if they say statements that they believe in astrology, so he said, okay, they believed in it. I'll say it might have been one opinion of many, or one opinion of two at least. He says, I'll attribute it to that school of thought, or I'll give a different interpretation of it. I'll say maybe that rabbi in that statement had an ulterior motive in what he wrote. Maybe he said something about astrology. Now, there's many statements of astrology in the Talmud. There's no question about it. And the Rambam says, I read all the books on the subject, and I find this astrology invalid. That's his opinion. There are people...
False.
Thank you. I find it false. Today, of course, there's millions of people who follow the horoscope and believe in astrology, and there's even Jewish people, there's even traditional Jewish people who believe in astrology. And I know one person who checks the date and the time when he was born and everybody else born, they find out what the constellations were at. And religious people, very religious people, people who study Torah every day. There are some people who believe till today in astrology. There were many rabbis. The Rambam says, even if it's the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Midrash and the Gemara who believe in astrology, will say that they had ulterior motive, or maybe something slipped by him at the time. You'll see later. I have a little excerpt from it in another sheet that I'm going to give out. So, now...
There wasn't an argument in the Mishnah.
I think he would still disagree, the Rambam. he would still disagree, but I'm just pointing out it happens to be that there was. Now, I'm going to give you out, this is something that I happen to have sent out today, to get these out. I have quite a few of the items that I'd like to discuss, that I already discussed and I'd like to discuss in these sheets. Now, this topic, I'm changing the subject now. From the Rambam changing his mind, from Mishnah to Gemara, Mishnah to Mishneh Torah, because the Shamir is not mentioned, he serves like the Nehemiah, against Rabbi, follows the Nehemiah, and he never mentions Shamir once in Mishneh Torah ever, at least according to the Bar Ilan computer, which confirmed it for me this evening at 7 o'clock or 6:30. Just, he never mentions the Shamir once in Mishneh Torah. Right. Well, we got hundreds of other hits. Everybody else mentions it. Half of them are Shamir Vashari, thorns and thistles. No, there's two Shamirs. There's the Shamir and that Shamir. So half of them are the other ones anyway. So that's why you get double the hits. Because it has 2 minutes. Okay, now this one, those of you that are on our fax or email list will have received this one this afternoon, because it was sent out. But we're not going to talk now about sacrifices, although it'll come up on the agenda. We're going to first point out to you, so section 4, because this is coming after part 1. Section 1, 2, and 3 are part 1. This is section 4 and 5, and we're going to look. Now, this one on page 2, this is sorry, we need page 1. We have to read something that he says on page 1. At the very beginning, I'm sorry that I made you all confused. Now, let's read the beginning, that where it's indented. That's the Rambam's words themselves. Our doctrine, this is the Rambam speaking, our doctrine is that all the precepts have a reason. All our sages' dicta proceed according to this principle, and the scriptural books indicate it. However, I found one utterance made by them in Bereshit Rabbah, which at first sight appears to imply that some commandments have no other reason than merely to prescribe a law, that no other purpose or benefit is intended by them. What does it matter? This is a statement now that the rabbis made, a very famous statement. What does it matter to the Holy One, blessed be He, that an animal is slaughtered by cutting its neck in front or in the back? What difference does it make to God? Now, of course, we say, well, it's much more humane to slaughter an animal front, because whatever. But this statement says, to God it makes no difference. They don't want to look at a reason. This statement, it looks like. Now, say therefore, this is what that statement says, that the commandments are given only to purify man. Right. Therefore, this goes against the Rambam's philosophy. Though this dictum, now the Rambam is speaking, though this dictum is very strange and has no parallel in the other dicta, I've interpreted in a manner that they will not be in contradiction to their views in their other statements as follows. The generalities only of the commandments necessarily have a cause and were given for a certain benefit. It is the details regarding which it was said that commandments were given with no ulterior object. Thus, killing an animal for obtaining good food is useful. Therefore, there's a reason. Is useful. How it should be killed was imposed with an intention to test man's obedience. I cite this example because it was mentioned by the sages. In reality, however, the commandment for the proper slaughter of an animal is intended to bring about the easiest death in the easiest manner. A more suitable example can be cited from the detailed commandments concerning sacrifices. The law that sacrifice should be brought is of great use. But why is one sacrifice a lamb while another is a ram? And why should a particular fixed number of them be brought? For such details, it is impossible to give an explanation. Those who believe these details have explanations are as far from the truth as those who imagine that the generalities of the commandments are not designed with a view towards some real benefit. They're just as far. If the school that thinks there's no reasons, no benefits, they're far. But the school that thinks you could give reasons to all the nitty-gritty details, they're just as far. It's impossible. You can't give explanations. No, they're two different schools. This school says there are reasons for everything, but they're wrong. There's not reasons for the nitty-gritty details. There's reasons for the major, the generalities. That's what he's saying here now. The other school says no reasons for anything. This student has reasons for everything. The other says, no, there's reasons for generalities. Not, you don't say, why is it a ram, not a lamb? How many, why is it one or two or three and not another number? Why is it seven, not eight? So, read the next paragraph. Wisdom requires, if you prefer to say necessity causes, that there be details impervious to explanation. That such a situation cannot be avoided can be seen from the following. The question, why a lamb and not a ram, would be asked if it were a ram and not a lamb. But something is required. Similarly, the question, why seven and not eight, would be asked if it were eight or ten or twenty. But a number is required. This is like the nature of possibilities in cases wherein one possibility must necessarily occur. One cannot ask why a particular possibility ensued. There were ten possibilities. One has to happen. When that happens, don't ask why did that one happen. Well, something has to happen. So whichever one happened, you'll ask, why did that happen? So that one can ask why a particular possibility ensued. The same question would be asked if it had been another possibility. By the way, they use this against considering great coincidences as having any meaning. When you say something had to happen, you know, out of millions of people, billions of people, something had to happen. So it happened, it happened. Something's going to happen. Anyway, some possibility is a necessity. Now, that's what the Rambam says here. He speaks very persuasively. I mean, whether we accept it or not, but he's trying hard to persuade his reader. Further in the guide, he provides reasons for many details of sacrifices. 20 chapters later, he explains why sacrifices were limited to the prescribed domestic species. He believes that a number of details are mandated to wean the people away from idolatry. He accepts the sage's explanation why the eighth day consecration requires atonement for the golden god. He presents a similar reason as to his opinion why he goes to prescribe sin offerings on the Chodesh festivals in Yom Kippur. To atone for Israel's disobedience and sacrifice into the Seirim that we read about in Ahare Mo'ed. On this very detail, he insists that the alternate explanation of the sages is solid. He said they have a very good explanation. The reason is to always seek forgiveness for the brother's sin in deceiving Yaakov after the sale of Yosef through slaughtering a goat. He provides reasons why bulls are stipulated for inadvertent transgression of the high priest and congregation and so on. He comments on why male or female animals are required for different situations, why young or old, why sacrifice is not acceptable before the eighth day. The inconsistency with his earlier rejection of the validity of the question why a lamb and not a ram and why a particular number is glaring. It has been assumed. Now, it's a clear-cut contradiction in the Rambam. It has been, 20 chapters later, in the third part, it has been assumed that in the previous context, he was providing an acceptable explanation to the statement of the sages that he was then interpreting. But his passionate, confident language in that context, striving hard to persuade the reader, asserting that for such details, impossible to give any explanation, that those who believe these details have explanations are as far from the truth as those who imagine that the generalities are not designed with a view towards some real benefit, as well as several other choice expressions, appears to have reflected his personal view. The attribution of reasons to the details was also articulated in a most fervent, extensive, and persuasive manner. Both of them were at length. It looks like he changed them. Although we cannot be sure, it does not appear this is an example of the intended contradictions he spoke of in his introduction to the guide, a device he felt constrained to employ for various reasons. Now, after the next two paragraphs, which are very important paragraphs, I just told you a little bit about them before, but does it not appear that, read the question afterwards, does it not appear that he changed his mind within the relatively short span of about 20 chapters? It's very likely that the Rambam did change, because we see movement. In Mishneh Torah we see movement. In the Moreh we see movement. We see movement in all over in the Rambam. The Rambam was a dynamic thinker. So first, let's ask a question because it should come up when you think about all this. The case of Tansipor is exactly the same as the opinion that says, what difference does it make if you slaughter the animal from the front or from the back? It's all the same, because it's all Gezat HaMeach, it's God's decree. What difference? Don't give any reasons, it's all God's decree. So the Tansipor story is repeated in the statement. It's all the same. The Rambam says, oh, it's an unusual statement, it's the only time they made a statement. It's not exactly right, because the ones who say the Tansipor, you're not allowed to say Tansipor Higiura HaMeacha, because the Gezat HaMelech, that's the same as this one, who says there's no difference in Shechita from the front or from the back. Yes?
If that's the case, how do you know you're not supposed to look for the mother to scare away to take the egg? This is not an issue of Rachamim, and it's not the...
Scare away the mother and take the egg. Okay, that's what the Torah says to do. God tells you to do that. Don't ask why. He told you to do that.
Right, so we should look for...
No, no, you don't have to go and do it. It's not that. It says when you finally come find it in the field. It's not. It's speaking in the sense. The context is important. It's speaking. You're going on a road and you come upon that. It's assuming. Now I'm telling you that you could be stubborn and say no. The Torah says it, so let's go and do it. Like some people do it. I saw a picture in the Jewish press of some Rebbe, Hasidic Rebbe. It happened to be in our neighborhood, and they brought a ladder. Oh, that's just the way it was. And they brought a ladder, and he climbed, and he went up, and he chased away the mother. No, a rabbi, 70 years old, 80 years old. He chased away the mother because he never had a chance to fulfill this mitzvah. He didn't want to be incomplete. So he chased away the mother, and he took the eggs. And then in Allenhurst this past summer, somebody had a nest, not going to mention his name, he had a nest, and he said, Rabbi, I know there are people paying a lot of money for this mitzvah. Can I sell it? Not here in this shul, he told me. He says, but I'll go to the synagogue. He says,
because nobody will buy it.
In Allenhurst, nobody will buy it. But, so he says, can I go and do it? I said, I think it's asur to make money on that. So he says, yeah, but I'll use it for a shul, he says. But that was a true story. It was on my block, and it was there, a nice bird's nest with eggs, and a mother bird hovering around the nest. It was a beautiful opportunity. But we don't look at it that way. We look at it that way. You want to take them. That's how we look at it. It's like Vincent Tress says, if a person's wife, he finds something wrong, he divorces her. It doesn't say, because Tress says divorce her, go and divorce your wife and then, you know, remarry her if you want. I mean, it doesn't say anything like that. The Torah gave rules and regulations for certain contexts. When the context was that you wanted, when you're having a problem in your marriage, so there's a regulation how to go about it. You write a sefer ketuvot and so on. When the person sees some food that he could use and he wants to take it, there's a way to go about taking it. It's not logical that the Torah is telling you on a matter like this to be frivolous and chase away the mother and take the child. No, it doesn't sound like when you don't need them that you should go and do it. And that's the way we approach it. We think, on the contrary, it's more cruelty, and cruelty does play a role. Right, one, right. Yeah, so these people could say, well, now I'm walking and it happens to be there in front of me. So. Okay, so now, being that the Tansipor has in it the same concept as the statement of what difference does it make to the Holy One, blessed be He, whether you slaughter the animal from the front or from the back, why didn't the Rambam bring down what he said about the Tansipor over here? And why did he just say this goes according to the other school and just get out of that statement? Why didn't he give the same explanation? One wonders why he did not merely attribute the rabbinic statement that the commandments were given only to purify man to another school of thought among the sages, one not accepted as normative, as he does on other occasions when he addresses a statement of theirs that does not coincide with his views. A strikingly similar example is the case of the Talmud explanation that the reason Mishnah ruled that a public reader says thy mercy is extended to the young birds must be silenced because he is defining God's laws motivated by mercy. Now, you can skip the rest of this paragraph because we already covered it. Now, or one further wonders why he did not treat the troublesome statement as he does statements of certain sages. We already covered this, but this one we'll read. In the Talmud, this is what he says, in the Talmud, Mishnah, and Midrashim, that contradict his position of totally rejecting any validity to astrology. See, I used the word validity before, and Jack, you corrected me correctly. It's falseness. No validity. I mean, it's all false.
He rejected it totally.
Yeah, he rejected it totally. For it is possible, this is what he says now, this is a quotation, for it is possible that something was unknown to him at that moment. This could be a rabbi in the Mishnah, by the way. Something was unknown to him at that moment, or perhaps his words were intended to hint at something, or perhaps he only said them for the moment, or due to some specific incident that occurred. Do you not see that many verses of the Torah are not to be taken literally? Don't take them literally. In his letter to the community of Marseille. Now, this is important because it shows that the Rambam considers the rabbis fallible. That's or they're saying things for ulterior motives, but the net upshot of this is that he considers them fallible, even though he's trying not to say those words. He's saying, well, maybe something was unknown to him at that moment. Probably the next moment he realized his mistake. At that moment, he said this when something was blocked out from him. But he's making them fallible, which is, because that's what we're doing with the Rambam tonight. Tonight's lecture, as I said, for the latecomers who didn't hear the opening statement, I said this is a very important topic because we're accustomed to studying Torah as we study the Torah Shebichtav, coming from Nevi'im. We're accustomed to studying Torah, even the post-Nevi'im, as if the great rabbis of our tradition are infallible, and as if halakha is given to us in a perfect state, and there's nothing that we could that we can think about and maybe find that maybe there's something has to be modified according to rules and regulations that come down in the tradition. And that's why studying the Rambam's life is all that important, because he's the first life that we have a good biography from his works and his letters. And we don't have, I don't think we have a previous personage in the traditional Jewish world, or in the Jewish world, period, that we have a nice collection of his writings and his letters extant, where we can see what's going on with him. And we see that he himself tells you, I'm fallible, I made mistakes, I followed the Geonim, they made the mistakes, they were wrong, I corrected them later, and so on. And he says, some Geonim, I won't even mention, some he mentions two of them, but he says, others I won't even mention because I have pity on them, I won't tell you who they are. You know, he's talking about the Geonim of Babel that were the leaders of the Jewish world in the previous centuries. At any rate, now we're up to, at any rate, on the issue. Oh no, that's not relevant to us tonight. Okay, so now we can go to the next topic. Now, the last yes, Rabbi.
On the issue of sacrifices, why not say that this contradiction is one of the fifth times that a teacher, sometimes when he starts teaching something, says it in a simple way, even though it's wrong, and then only later goes into the details. That seems to me what
on
the reasons for particulars of sacrifices.
On the particulars.
He wants us to, of course, to focus on the big thing.
Right, but you know the only thing I agree that would be a possibility. The Rambam says in his introduction that there are some times that there necessarily will be a contradiction between one statement, an earlier statement, and a later statement. And Rabbi Ricky brought up one of the reasons that you'll sometimes find a contradiction because in the earlier stage, you have to teach a student to go more slowly. So maybe you want them to focus on generalities first. You don't want them to get bogged down with specifics. But the only problem with that's what I said over here. I said it doesn't sound like it's the contradictions intentional, like his introduction, because he's telling you with very sharp language. He's not just directing the student away from it. He's telling you it's impossible and they're as far from the truth. He's planting in the mind of a lot of, you know that Encyclopedia Judaica quotes that as the Rambam's position, that first one. And under Maimonides, I have a big entry on Maimonides, Encyclopedia Judaica, mm-hmm. and one of the statements that they attribute, right, I brought you down the first out of one little piece, but one of the statements that they sort of praised the Rambam for was that earlier statement that he said, details have no reasons. Mm-hmm. They like that. And the scholars today, obviously somebody wrote that article in the encyclopedia, and they don't quote the following, the 20 chapters later statement that he gave reasons for the details. I mean, that's, I feel a complaint on the Judaica, mm-hmm. but whoever wrote that, but I'm just pointing out, Rabbi, that it doesn't seem that that first statement can be taken as an intentional statement for the students in the earlier stages until they're more familiar with giving reasons for generalities and then go to the specifics. It doesn't sound that way. Anyway, but as I said, we can't be sure. I want to make sure. I told Rabbi Labaton this question yesterday or the day before, and I said, you know, I'm giving a class Monday night, and I told him, and I like your opinion. You've been reading Rambam for the last 30 years, and you're an expert on the Rambam. What do you think about this question? These 20 chapters. He knew exactly which chapters I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, he says, without looking over those 20 chapters in between, he says, I won't hazard an opinion. That's what he told me. He says, I won't give an opinion. He says, I have to look over the hope to see if this is possible. Because I told him, to me, it does not look like the Rambam did this intentionally. It looks like he held that way. At any rate, we can see a change in the Rambam's perspective, in my opinion, in the following. Let's look in Mishneh Torah, over here, item 5. Roman numeral 5, but first we'll go to the bottom paragraph. We'll skip the paragraph of sacrifice. You see, the reason that I'm writing this on these sheets, my mind is on sacrifices, part 2, is because I've been asked this question for many, many years. I mean, every rabbi is asked this question by enlightened people. They say, in Mishneh Torah, the Rambam spent a tremendous amount of energy, time, chapters on giving the details of the sacrifices, but you don't know how detailed they are. The laws of the sacrifices of the Olah, and the Mincha, and the Shilamim, and the Hatat, and the Asham, and the Beit HaMikdash, and the Kohanim. Tremendous amount of details. Nothing less than, if a person just put out what the Rambam did in those sections in his life, he would be at the top of the rabbinic world for centuries. It was such a tremendous work that the Rambam put out on codifying the laws of sacrifices. And then in the Moreh Nevuchim, but that's part one, not we're in part two. Tonight we weren't making, but I'll just tell you why this is being discussed in this Perashah. It's really, the Rambam says sacrifices were concession to human nature. And God did not really, the way he says it, God did not really want to give us the law of sacrifices, but the people could not have imagined serving him without sacrifices. Had there not been a law of sacrifice in the Torah, they would have been tempted to do sacrifices for idolatry, mm-hmm. because they just understood you. That's how you worship. Worship was you bring an animal. Maybe people thought the animal is what helps in atonement, maybe whatever they thought, but they thought it, and it was universal, and we know today that it was universal. And in the ancient Near East, in all those countries around Israel, there's no question of altars and animals and all over the place, and probably was universal, yes. And the Rambam says they just couldn't live without it. So therefore, God gave us laws about sacrifices to him, but he limited them only one place in the world. You could bring sacrifices. Everybody else is bringing sacrifices all over the place. For us, no, you can only bring sacrifices in the selected place. First Mishkan, then Beit HaMikdash, and then sacrifices on certain occasions, and says back and forth, and you can't always go into the temple because you have to leave Tahara if you're in Tamea. He says that's the reason for Tamar itself, that you shouldn't go to the temple too often. I mean, that's something that I'll just be alluding to later in these in this study, that the laws of purity and impurity are partly to prevent you from going to the temple. That you don't go there too often. Don't get some deliberate, have more respect for it. I mean, that you're going to have it, so have respect for it. So this is a question that many ask. Did the Rambam change his mind about sacrifices? Would he vote on the Sanhedrin, had there been a Sanhedrin in his days, would he have voted for reinstituting sacrifices? Mm-hmm. So many think that he would not have. One day in Israel, I saw they're having a conference. I called up, can I come? I'm not a member. Hartman's Institute. I get there, they were talking about exactly this question. What would the Rambam's view be about reinstituting sacrifices? And there are some modern Orthodox, maybe some conservatives in the Hartman's Institute, that this was an issue being discussed. It's good, people are discussing it. The Rambam gives an example. He says, if you want to know what it would be like, imagine if a prophet came to us today, he writes, and told us, from this point on, you're no longer to serve God with prayer. You are to serve Him with meditation. You don't have to any longer fast. We're changing the laws. You have to just meditate upon His grandeur and no more prayers. You don't have to utter anything anymore. We're not going to have a chazan. We're not going to have a minyan. You just have to meditate. He says, how would people receive that? So there's been a discussion on that statement in the Rambam. Does he mean that statement seriously? Because he always speaks about meditation is the ultimate level of service of God. He always talks about reach the stage, study Torah, study the Gemara, get to know the Dabar Katan, Abaye, Verabba, all the discussions of Gemara. Then you study, meanwhile, you're also studying your sciences and your metaphysics and you're understanding more about the Creator in the negative way they can understand, that it's not this, not that, not that, and so on, and you go higher and higher, and you meditate upon His greatness and His grandeur, and so on and so forth. And it's a life of intellect, it's a life of apprehension of the Creator, of comprehension or perception, and those are the words that the Rambam is constantly using. So he gives that example. Imagine if we told you that the prophet told you that's what we probably couldn't accept. Most people couldn't accept that prophet. We would just not accept it. We still would pray. We still would go to shul. We still would say you have to. So that's why this is here. But I don't really want to discuss that tonight. Somebody came to my home on Shabbat. I can't remember this Shabbat or last Shabbat. Somebody knocked on the door, and he came in. And he asked, can I ask you a question? I don't know who the person is. My wife asked him his name, so she got his name. Certain boy in the community, he asked me, I think he said this based on the fact that it's this week, and he saw the topic put out by Merkaz on a flyer. I think that's why he asked. I couldn't figure out any other reason. He says, do you hold that the Rambam changed opinion on sacrifices, that we don't have to do sacrifices in the future? So he asked me, like, accusatory type of question. Right. At my house, okay, on Shabbat afternoon. He knocked on the door and he asked me, do you believe, I said, I never said that. He said, no, you speak about the Rambam changed his mind. So somebody told him, obviously, somewhere, that based on the fly, somebody told him that probably Rabbi Shammah is going to speak about changing his mind on the sacrifices. Anyway, that's not the topic of tonight. That's just the topic of these sheets. And no, it's not exactly the topic of the sheets. I just talk about it. Mm-hmm. It's not really a topic. But I'd like to go on to the next subject tonight.
One question, please. Some people seem to be attracted to Buddhism because meditation seems to be associated with Buddhism. Am I right?
A lot of people are attracted to it. But we have something very important to say about the Rambam and his meditation. Very important to say, and I'm leaving it for the last topic of the evening. Is it time to start the last topic of the evening? It takes like 10 minutes or so. This is a very important topic. And I mentioned it to Dr. Gindy the other day in our class, that this is what I feel that reveals about the Rambam's philosophy ultimately, more than anything else does, the Rambam throughout the Guide the Perplexed, and in Mishneh Torah even, and even from before that, the Rambam is always the promoter of thinking and intellect and intellectual perception. And in the Moreh, he makes statements as follows. He says, do not spend your time interacting with people. It's a waste of time. He says, and he uses the following words, which at least the Hebrew translation of the Moreh of Ibn Tibbon, which was done in his lifetime, he says, you have to look at them like animals. You know, to keep away from them because you'll get harmed. They give you harm. You have to focus on the real responsibility of a human being to apprehend the Creator and to spend your time in contemplation and in meditation. Something like you just brought up, a little bit like that. But that's what he says in the Moreh. And he says it a number of times, and he's known for that. And like Dr. Gindi, I mentioned it to you because you had mentioned something like that on that occasion, that the Rambam is known to be, that's it. Now, that's the way he's looked at in a number of places in Mishneh Torah and in the Moreh Nebuchim, where he says the ultimate goal and so on. It's not the study of Torah per se. The study of Torah is to help you move forward. It's not the study of the sciences and physics and metaphysics. It's right. Metaphysics takes you to a higher level of apprehending the Creator. Now, in Mishneh Torah, if there's time after this topic, I have a few more topics, but now I don't want to lose this one. In the Mishneh Torah and the Moreh Nebuchim, you won't find in the formal codifications and in the formal expression of his philosophy, you won't find anything like you'll find in his letters and in the later part of his life. The Moreh Nebuchim is 1190 when it was completed. We have a few letters subsequent to that. He passed away 1204. In that 14-year period, we have a letter of the Rambam about his daily activity. And I'd like you to read, that's the second side of these sheets. We'd like to read this whole page. First, we'll read the right side, which I had the secretary photostat from the Encyclopedia Judaica, because a very famous letter, some words, some... Now, and then we'll read this article. I mean, this is part of a book by Abraham Joshua Heschel called Maimonides. So I photostated one of the pages near the end, which is very interesting. And this is another change in the Rambam. Now, the following passage in the letter to the translator of the guide that Shmuel ben Yehuda ibn Tibbon, in which he describes his multifarious cares and duties with the aim of dissuading Ibn Tibbon from coming to visit him as often as possible. You know, Ibn Tibbon writes a letter to the Rambam. He says, I have to come visit you and talk with you. And he asks him a lot of questions about the Moreh Nebuchim. He says, I'm going to translate it. The Rambam says, your father's a famous man, and I had so much respect for him because his father's also a famous translator. He said, and it's great. I see from your writing, you know, he's really a dignified scholar in his own right, Ibn Tibbon. And the Rambam gives him advice about how to translate, and he answers a lot of questions that he has. Very, very nice letter. And then he tells him, but to come to meet me, to talk to me, he says, forget it. What are you going to talk to me? That's what this says. We're going to read this now. I dwell at Masr. Masr was Egypt, but Masr, it was right, the old Cairo was called Masr. Fastad. And the Sultan resides at Al-Kahira. That's Cairo, Kahira. Masr was really Cairo, but then they built, even in the 12th century, they built a new Cairo where the Sultan was. Where do we get? Mitzrayim, of course, it's from Mitzrayim. These two places are two Sabbath days' journey distant from each other. A Sabbath day journey is 2,000 amot, 4,000 amot, and a map is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So you get 4,000 amot, could be 6,000 feet or 7,000 feet, that's a mile and a half. Like, he can't just walk there, you're not next door. Mm-hmm. and my duties to the Sultan are very heavy. I am obliged to visit him every day, early in the morning, and when he or any of his children or any of the inmates of his harem, it doesn't say that, it just says Pilekshim. I don't know, maybe.
Members.
Yeah, inmates of his harem are indisposed. I dare not quit Al Kahira, but must stay during the greater part of the day in the palace. It also frequently happens that one or two royal officers fall sick, and I must attend to their healing. Hence, as a rule, I repair to Al Kahira very early in the day, and even if nothing unusual happens, I do not return to Masr until the afternoon. Then I am almost dying with hunger. I find the antechambers filled with people, both, I think it says Gentiles first. In my edition, it says Goyim and Yehudim, Jews and Gentiles, nobles and common people, judges and bailiffs, friends and foes, a mixed multitude who await the time of my return. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, go forth to my patients, and entreat them to bear with me while I partake of some slight refreshment, the only meal I take in the 24 hours. Now, you know, in Mishneh Torah, at the beginning, the Rambam speaks about the proper diet, and a person should eat regularly, and should do some exercise. Yeah. You should do some exercise before the meals, and on a regular basis. And, but he has no time to even follow his own instructions, and he's telling Ibn Tibbon, that's my only meal in, I think, the 24 hours. Then I go forth to attend to my patients and write prescriptions and directions for their various ailments. Patients go in and out until nightfall, and sometimes even, I solemnly assure you, until 2 hours or more in the night. I converse with and prescribe for them while lying down from sheer fatigue. And when night falls, I am so exhausted I can scarcely speak. In consequence of this, no Israelite can have any private interview with me except on the Sabbath. On that day, the whole congregation, at least the majority of the members, come to me after the morning service when I instruct them as to their proceedings during the whole week. We study together a little until noon. When they depart, some of them return and read with me after the afternoon service, they prayed Mincha Gedolah, until evening prayers. In this manner, I spend that day. So you're going to come here. When are you going to speak to me? That's what he's telling us. Now, see, this is the point that Heschel brings out, but many suspect it. But Heschel writes about it. It's very nice. It says the Rambam made a major change in his life. In 1890, when he finished in Morir, he made a major change. In those last 14 years, he became very differently oriented than he had been in his writings. Let's read this, the left side.
Heschel, what book?
It's called Maimonides, this one. It's essays. I think they were a gathering of... the last one, I think he published
biography,
this one.
It's a
biography of Maimonides. It's a nice light biography by Heschel of Maimonides.
Mm-hmm.
You have one here? You have one over this one? Yeah. So, throughout, let's read from the third line from the top. Throughout his life, he was helpful to many lands and places with his letters and notes of consolation. He solidified many communities of Israel in the faith. His wisdom was joined by great piety and generosity. His house was open to everyone. He's quoting from somebody over there. As supreme head of the Jews, now Heschel is speaking, as supreme head of the Jews, Maimonides had a lofty political position. He was considered the premier physician of his age, the most important Talmudist of the millennium, under the millennium, that's 1,000 years of the millennium, an epoch-making philosopher, an outstanding mathematician, scientist, and jurist. He was admired by the masses, honored by princes, celebrated by scholars. He corresponded with famous rectors and insignificant judges. The complaints of the simple filahs, the diseases and whims of the rulers, the spiritual and physical sufferings of the harem took up his attention. He maintained the most cultivated forms of court etiquette, as well as plain helpfulness and cordiality toward the most common of men. In all this, he asserted his retiring, self-willed personality. The sick and heavily suffering man, he's talking about the Rambam, the sick and heavily suffering man did not rest. The impulses that had been forcing him to do scholarly work all his life drove him now to the patients. In his ethics, he fought against negation of life, asceticism, and he taught the middle path, balance. However, his self-sacrifice went far beyond equilibrium. He was a man of willpower, resolution, and freedom. He devoted the last 15 years of his life purely to medicine with more energy than he had sacrificed in the 10 years of the codification, which was unbelievable amount of energy. I mean, that's known. The passion for scholarly labor, dominating him since his youth, was replaced by a different motive. After the final chapter of the Gartra Perplexed, he wrote nothing but responsa and one epistle, his plan to write a book on the Haggadah, not Haggadah Pesach, the Haggadah, he would say, the Haggadot, the Nedashim. Mm-hmm. He wanted to write a book on the Haggadah, demonstrating philosophy from Judaism and thus legitimizing his own philosophy. His wish to translate his Arabic writings into Hebrew. He had wrote about that. He wanted to do that. The necessity of completing the Talmudic commentary he had started once before. He started a commentary on Gemara. His work on the Jerusalem Talmud. His desire to compile the promised book of sources on which the future of the Codex's life's work depended. He didn't write sources for Mishneh Torah. His life's work. He didn't write sources. And people started saying, they write a list all over the world. They say, we need the sources. We can't study from it. They say, one day I'll do it. But he never did it. All these things were given up, and he now only treated the ill. At the height of his life, that's what he spent the whole day. Morning, treating the ill of the Sultan and his palace and his ministers and his family. And the afternoon, he's treating the ill in his home, and then he's fatigued.
I'm wondering, how big was the harem?
I don't know. At the height of his life, the Muslims could take four wives, I don't know. But at the height of his wife, he turned from metaphysics to medicine, from contemplation to practice. That was Maimonides' last transformation. See, Heschel puts it as a transformation in Maimonides himself. His biography might be describing previous transformations in him, but like maybe when his brother passed away, because there was a period of his life that his brother supported him, and the Rambam had the leisure to just concentrate on his studies. Then his brother passed away in about 1169 or so, and the Rambam had to go into medicine. He went into medicine, he writes, only because he had to make a living, and he didn't feel the problem. His brother was in business, and he drowned on a ship with all his... He was dealing in precious stones, and he drowned all his merchandise, and he left a widow and children, and said, I'm going to take care of everybody. So he had to go into medicine, which he had studied previously, in order to support the family. Anyway, that was my mind's transformation from contemplation to practice, from knowledge to the imitation of God. God was not only, you know, it's an imitation of God. We say, this very famous rabbinic statement, it says, a few times rabbis say, Mahu rahum after rahum, mahu hanun after hanun. As he's merciful, you have to be merciful. As he's gracious, you be gracious. As he's kovei metin, you have to be kovei metin. As he's merchem avelim, as he's rofei cholim, you have to be rofei cholim. There's different rabbinic statements on that. That, you know, Heschel, we're reading Heschel. Heschel was, although he was in a conservative institution, the Jewish Scholarly Seminary, he was one of the heads over there for many years. But he is really, maybe he was a shomei mitzvot person. I mean, I don't want to be quoted. You have the tape over here. I'm not saying that, you know, we're justifying a person who's at JTS, but Heschel was a person very committed to Torah and Mitzvot. I remember when I was teaching the Mir Yeshiva, there was one of the rabbis, when we had lunch, the rabbis sit at one table, and one of them was talking about Heschel, that he always sends him the books, or he sends him, or one of his relatives, he always sends him his books, and they maintain certain interaction with him. Anyway, just saying, that's who we're reading right now. So now, he was the model one should follow, at a capital M. His works, the creatures of the world which he guides in providence, you know, that God, his works, the creatures of the world which God guides in providence, replace abstract conceptions which constitute a spiritual act through intellectual knowledge of God, right? Those abstract conceptions were what it is. Now it's this concrete. The observation of and absorption in concrete events replaced abstract viewing. Now the thinker no longer made any effort to deny any characteristic of God. In the Morena Buchim, he's always saying, you can't say anything positive about God. It's always negative. You dispel negative ideas. Instead, he strove to become similar to God in his actions. The most vehement enemy of all anthropomorphisms, that's the Rambam, the most vehement enemy of interpreting God in human terms, which tried to make God similar to man, he was the enemy of that, found that the ultimate conclusion of wisdom was to become similar to God, just as the cosmic motion of the spheres and all the events of this world take place in order to become similar to God. So I think there's a lot to be said for this last statement of Heschel, that when you read what the Rambam was doing, in his own words, you see that he did place these, what we would say, based on his earlier philosophy, these creatures who you should recognize can only distract you and can only remove you from your high calling of meditating upon the Creator. But these creatures, they had needs, and it was our responsibility to provide them those needs. And as we'll read in Haftarah this week, Haftarah is Yirmiyah chapter 7. But at the end of the Haftarah, they skip to chapter 9, they read those Pesukim. That's the only thing to take pride in, that you recognize that I, Hashem, am interested in doing kindness, justice, and righteousness in the land. This is what I want. And ultimately, and actually, I've always wondered about this, and I concluded this statement. In the last chapter of the Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam speaks a little bit this way, in the last chapter. And if you look, it's right, Shulchan Aruch, the Hagaha Shulchan Aruch, in the very early part of Eisei Man Be'et, quotes it, that a person, when he's in the presence of a king, a regular human king, he conducts differently, so you should always remember you're in the presence of the Almighty and so on, the way you conduct and everything you do. He starts speaking a little bit like this. Anyway, this is another change in the Rambam, which completes the evening. There are a whole bunch of topics in between that we didn't get to talk about. That'll have to be some other occasion. Okay, so give a couple of minutes to questions.
He seems to have been saying keep away from people, in the same way like Shimon ben Yochai when he was in the
In those stages, he would appreciate that Rabbi Shimon went into a cave. He would appreciate that. And he says sometimes you have to go leave the city. If there are certain cities, if you're having certain kind of problem, you leave. And the Rambam was in the Moreh. He's very much focused on meditations and contemplation. That's the purpose of man.
The ultimate purpose of man.
The perfection
of midot.
Yes, but that's midot. All. Yes, perfection of midot. But perfection of midot is introductory.
Right.
It's all. But you move through that to a higher stage, and that's why his own life in the last 14 years did not exhibit that. That's the point. It exhibited what we would today say, and we mostly saying for most of the traditional Jewish world believe is the more appropriate, the more correct viewpoint, which is that we must stay involved. That, as Heschel defined it at the end, is as God is being Hanun and Rahum and Minahim Abilim and Rofei Holim and so on, we have to participate in social interaction with the people and make people feel better and cure them and help them and provide for their needs and so on. Malbish Arumim and Ma'achil Re'evim, all of that's the responsibility. Anybody else? Time. Okay, we'll say Kaddish.